This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 89, brought to you in association with Blue Meter Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Alexander Ball, FinTech Manager at ING. We've heard a few times in the podcast about slow decision-making processes in incumbent FS. To some, this is an opportunity to set up a new FS firm that moves faster, quicker. Though, as we're seeing in app-only banking at the moment, the answer to the old Top Gear question of how hard can it be turns out correctly to be harder than you ever imagined, Sonny. To others, the tech fintechers, as it were, this slow decision-making process can be very painful. Of course, this is a generic situation in any industry vertical. In the nature of our connected world, there are generally a few oligopolistic players dominating a marketplace. In this context, actually, FS is pretty rare. There are many, many players, well short of, say, the oligopoly that one sees in pharmaceuticals or telecoms. Nevertheless, new startups or scale-ups operate very different business models in all verticals from the huge incumbents. Whilst large firms ponder their decisions, the newbies with a great idea sometimes keel over and die. Anyway, we all know all of this, but less discussed is how the incumbents handle it. What are their challenges and constraints? What's it like to have 1,000 suitors knocking at your door, all telling you that they are wonderful and the key to the future? One way of looking at this is as a dating problem requiring matchmakers, of whom we've had several of various types on the show. Accenture, Direct Line, Matchy.biz, Startup Bootcamp, Igniter, and most recently Illuminate Finance, who are very specifically focused on this issue. Founder Mark Beeston, with plenty of solid FS experience himself, gave us some insights recently into this. I think my main takeaway was his model of innovate, validate, and adopt. To believe that one needs to innovate more when there are thousands of innovations out there is, to me, a mistake for an incumbent. He also emphasised the heterogeneous nature of incumbents. I cringe when I read time and time again something slagging off banks, in inverted commas. All banks are absolutely not all the same, and we cannot paint them all with the same brush. So, on to ING. You may have heard of them. They have just announced a €300 million fund to invest in fintechs, have well over 100 fintech partnerships, that's a lot of Christmas cards. The most well-known partnership of theirs is perhaps with Cabbage, whereby ING customers can access up to €100,000 online within minutes. ING has 50,000 staff, €50 billion of equity, and they were a startup almost 300 years ago. Alex is a man of taste and distinction, as we'll come on to soon, and his day job is in charge of managing a small team of fintech scouts and analysts on behalf of his bank. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Alex. Thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Mike. Can I just say, look, I've been listening to your show for several years now, so it's a real pleasure to be with you here today. You and your guests have given me a lot of value over the years, so I hope in turn that I can do the same for your listeners.
Well, I'd like to thank you for that, and I've really got good value for my £5 note that I gave you earlier, because I've been feeling unloved recently, so I thought paying for flattery was probably the way. But in terms of you being a man of taste and distinction, we met at Lendit recently, and you found a clear way on the show, which is a new and innovative way to get onto the show, of being the first person to ask me for a selfie.
Indeed, but it's not every day I get to meet some of my fantastic idols of mine, yeah?
Idols of yours, my God. If you think you're actually going to get away with some easy bowling after this by Flannery, you're probably right, actually. But I apologise to listeners in advance, and we've all got to be politically correct these days in the totalitarian world we live in. So presumably I'm no longer allowed by some regulator somewhere to say that it's very flattering to have a selfie, and I was very pleased to send it to my daughters just to show that sort of dad isn't as boring as they might perceive. But on the other hand, one never quite gets what one wants in life, and probably my ideal vision of what a podcaster has thrown at him was not a gentleman with a beard such as yours. Nothing against beards, of course, or techies or gentlemen's, but I had better ideas than that. And we were talking at the time about podcasts, and you were talking about the idea that you thought there was more competition these days.
There's certainly more competition in terms of trying to get my attention in the space, which is fintech. Fintech's a pretty broad church, and We're seeing more and more movement in that field and subsections of fintech now. So fintech and insurtech and regtech and all of these other great spin-offs that's coming.
Yes, and I think my response to that was that I didn't think there was any competition. How did you interpret my perspective that there wasn't any competition other than as a sign of insanity that you were well aware of?
The competition is really about, look, why are you doing this? Yeah, is it because of the love for the audience, the love for the content that you're producing, because it's something that you're really interested in, but is it because that you want to make sustainable business out of your podcast?
Well, you've asked me the question. I used to be asked questions, actually. I've got a moment of complete existential doubt at the moment. Why am I doing that? I don't know, actually. I'm doing it because I'm doing it, actually. It seemed like a good idea at the time is perhaps the way. Well, I think in terms of no competition, I think it's a very interesting perspective. He says, feeling like he's playing a rather difficult chess opening. In that, in any new field, let's just take this in terms of internet addresses. Some time ago, and it was some time ago now, when internet interweb addresses came along, somebody thought, oh, I'll register sex.com. That's really good because people are going to type in sex, and certainly they type in sex more than anything else. And having sex.com was a really useful website to have. But once that's taken, then coming back to your speciation about regtech and all these different types of subsets, what you've then got to go for is, I don't know, lesbiansex.com. And then when lesbiansex.com has gone, you've got to have another name added to it. And as you say, you get more and more speciation and you get more and more focus in that area.
Oh, it becomes more and more niche. Yes, you have a more and more niche customer segments.
Exactly, that's right. And I think it doesn't really matter what your niche is, how much your microscope is focused on an area. I think that the don't compete thing still applies. Peter Thiel is a great one for this, the founder of PayPal.
So make your own path.
Partly make your own path, but just do what you do in the best ways. Let's take a different example. So when I was a lad in Birmingham, the culture in this country was never eating out, largely because real English food is rubbish. And in Birmingham, which for foreigners is the second largest city in England, there was a million people in those days, there was only one restaurant in town, which was a Chinese restaurant. And as a result of this, next to nobody ever went out and certainly didn't go to the Chinese restaurant. There were hotels, and occasionally we would eat in a hotel at Christmas. So naively, you might think that when more restaurants are created, it's more competition for that restaurant. But let's say, for the sake of argument, it was the only Chinese restaurant. Well, more restaurants get created, then more people get introduced to the idea of eating out. And if you're the Chinese restaurant and you're doing the sort of Chinese food in your own way that you want, you can actually find that what's apparently more competition is actually just increasing the overall size of the market. And if you're cooking really nice Chinese food, then you're going to get more people arising, despite the perversity of more competition. And I think this is definitely true in the case of podcasts, because podcasts have quite a high penetration in the US, but in the UK and I think in Europe, it's still very much a minority habit. So if new podcasts come along, I think it just increases that people are going to listen to podcasts. And in terms of what I'm trying to do, which is sing my own song in my own way, bring my 30 years in FS and deep understanding of what FS means to the new world, then I don't think there's any competition of that, because the other podcasts that are out there are trying to do different things. They have different sort of artists in mind, or they're different. It's like TV programs. Imagine the television where there's only one program on and it comes on every 2 weeks. Not many people are going to buy a TV.
I remember those days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas when you've got more TV programs, as long as they're all different, you know, there is no competition between, shall we say, breakfast TV and the football.
Sure.
Have I won this sure. argument?
Look, we can always go into micro segments and customer segments, and as long as there is a customer out there that you are servicing their need, then I think that, yeah, you've got a winning argument. But as long as there is a customer there.
Well, you're the customer, so...
Well, I'm the customer, so... So, yeah, you've validated your arguments.
And I think, well, like everything, it's a spectrum. And with fintech as a whole, I think there is a lot that's underplayed in terms of artistic integrity, as it were. And it's not really a concept that often applies to these. But the examples I would give would be, for example, Zopa or RateSetter or Funding Circle. You know, these are the largest peer-to-peers. They're probably some of the largest fintechs that exist in London. And I think, by and large, the founders have done an excellent job of having a vision and sticking to it. As a result of having a vision and sticking to it, going back to my quote from Lemmy that I was coming up with, play your music, the audience will find you, generally not true in the internet world, but when it works really well. Zopa are stuck with consumer loans. Funding Circle are doing that. And what I see is that there are plenty of people who are me-toos, or apparently, as you say, market-driven. I mean, it's a very sensible thing, you know, find customers and sell them something they want. Well, you can't disagree with that.
Yes.
But if you're not careful, you don't really have any artistic vision. You don't have any sort of style about you. And let's take app-only banks. I mean, I've got the Monzo card and it's been a disaster last week. It keeps crashing all the time. They tell me that it won't be and the current account starts and I do not do it. But no one would ever accuse Tom of not having a vision for Monzo.
Sure. And look, you need that. As a strategy for your business, you need a clear vision, a North Star, something to guide you and your troops around you about where you're going. It helps to also disperse the noise, yeah?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
But as well, if there is a good business model out there, you are going to get the fast followers and the people that are going to try and copy that and trying to move in, you know, in that space. So,
yes, and I think coming back to, you know, career advice in general, let's broaden it out from business. I saw a very good diagram once because for some time, I don't like the word millennials, but for some time, youngsters, whatever that means, were told to sort of follow their bliss and go and do your heart's desire. And in the modern world, you can do anything. You know, great advice, but as somebody put it once very well and it stuck in my mind, that's a unique historical experience because never in human history have parents told their offspring, go and do what you love. Never, ever, ever. You know, if you're a son of a cobbler, you were a cobbler. If you're a farmer, you're a farmer. Now, it's possible to do all these things these days. But the trouble with going to do what you love, let's say you love playing the guitar. The chances of ever playing the guitar and making money out of it is roughly zero. It's vanishingly small. It's vanishingly small. And the diagram I saw, which sticks in my mind, if you imagine three circles overlapping in the middle, then the three circles where ideally you're finding a sweet spot are something you love, something you're good at. You may love playing the guitar, but crap at it. And something where people are going to pay money. If you can find something you love, something you're good at, and paying money where those three circles are overlapping, that's then the ideal perspective. So talking of finding something you love, something you're good at, and something you're paying money, clearly your whole life has been orientated towards ending up as a fintech manager at ING, and you've been completely successful in that. So how did you get to that point, and what did you learn along the way?
Okay, so I'll try to keep it relatively short. So I have a background in IT. Yeah, I studied computer science at university, and then when I finished my degree, I came straight into the city. I wanted to work for financial services and have done for over 15 years.
So you did computer science about 20 years after I did it. What were the sort of core focuses? So when I did computer science, the core focus was pretty much around operating systems and computer languages.
Yeah, C++, things like Pascal, databases. Yes. So 20 years later, we're still focusing on that. But we had some funky stuff as well, like user design, user computer to design. And I specialised in some 3D modelling as well, which was relatively exciting back then.
I suspect that 10 years later than you, computer science had changed quite a lot again, actually, because a lot of the stuff that you hear these days, especially around so-called AI or machine learning, it's really actually relatively recent that it's been sort of taught to undergraduates.
Well, it's the hype now, isn't it? It's the hype cycle that it's on, and there's a lot of investment, so there's a lot of institutional money that's going into it, a lot of development, so it makes it more and more interesting for academia. But yeah, I mean, if I think back, I mean, now as well, a lot of programs will be focused on, you know, these devices, mobile phones. The iPhone only came out in 2007. So, okay, it's been around for a decade now, but, I mean, growing up when I was a kid, we didn't have a mobile phone. So it's, you know, very different, very different.
So how did you get from the IT stuff to the fintech world?
I joined ING back in 2010 as a market data manager. And anybody who works in market data knows that it's a little bit like a cottage industry. It's a bit of a niche sector and very difficult for generalists to get involved in. Now, the thing that I really liked about it was really there was a blend of technology and finance, and my role there was about origination, going to the business, finding out their data requirements, then going externally to try and source that. And it might be speaking to some of the big vendors like your Bloombergs or your Thomson Reuters, but it might be some of the smaller boutiques. And then it was really about evaluating those services, setting up demos, and then working with procurement and legal and negotiating contracts. And then finally, once that's been done and agreed, then really sort of technically delivering those services. So working very closely with IT security, firewalls, networks, the server sides. So really implementing it and handing it over. So the whole chain from really origination, evaluation, negotiation to implementation. So that was my role when I first joined them.
By the sound of it, that's absolutely generic. Only these days it's called fintech and there are more people to chat up outside the organisation than the couple of large players. So moving on to this question about how large banks partner with fintechs and how they do the dating and the mating bit about it, as it were. From your perspective, from ING's perspective, why you guys bother doing all this in the first place?
Well, look, right, and if I go from ING's perspective, I mean, innovation is very much a core component of our strategy. So we can see that the bank is being disrupted by technology and we need to be able to stay relevant. And we can do that in a few ways. Yeah, we can adapt, we can change our organisation, we can change our way of working, adopt a more agile approach, become more digital. We can do these things ourselves or we can do it with partners. And so to me, banks working with fintechs can create these win-win situations because fintechs, really, they have the speed, they have the agility, they're very close to the customer with sort of differentiating propositions. They can target niche customers. But the great thing about this agility is that some of these fintechs, well, I would say, they have the luxury of not having many customers, which means that they can take more risk. They can really pivot and change their business model almost overnight on a customer insight. And this is something really powerful. Now, for banks, of course, they have deep pockets. So they have the financial power, but they have a strong customer base, which can be leveraged. They have the distribution channels, a presence in multiple countries. They have a lot of internal expertise. So people may be from market data, but people from legal, people from IT, financial backgrounds, regulatory risk. All of those expertise and capabilities can be leveraged as well. Now, most of all, though, what I consider the biggest asset that banks have is their brand. Yeah, they have a lot of brand equity that they've built up over the years, and with that brings them the trust. Because this is really important within financial services. Trust is a key component because you're dealing with people's money. So I believe that through partnerships, working together, big banks, smaller startups, fintechs, we can create win-win situations, new value units where both parties can really succeed.
Right, that sounds very good and rather more comprehensive than my sort of one sentence answer to why, because it's helpful. That's not even a sentence, is it really? And we'll come on to in a bit the mating thing or the docking. I mean, you know, just in terms of how you're talking there, for the sake of argument, you can imagine a fintech as being a circle and a large bank with its organograms and departments as being a square. And the challenge for, I assume, a department like yours is how you match up the circles and the squares in some sort of airlock way. But before we get into the sort of the dating and the mating challenge, having said why you guys are up for it, there are many types of ways that banks interact with the fintech world. As far as your experience, I mean, more just talking about the industry as a whole rather than sort of which ones ING picks, as it were, sort of how do banks interact with fintechs?
If you look at the industry, I mean, banks are really approaching this mainly in five ways. So they do it through their innovation labs, through accelerators. They can do it through proof of concepts, actually doing an experiment together. And then mainly doing it through partnerships, through commercial agreements or through investments.
Right. OK, so five different ways of doing it. There's a sort of the sixth way, which was quite common but becoming less common, which was the ignore it completely approach. And I was talking to somebody who knows the insurance market very well recently, and he was telling me that actually behind the scenes, the reality is that most insurers are basically ignoring insurtech, you know, behind all the propaganda. There's one or two that are really going for it and doing it quite well. So it's really a question of how much weight behind initiatives, you know, for the sake of argument. I'm sure probably every large insurance company, if they were quizzed at an AGM about how they're approaching insurtech, would have a line. But in terms of how much sort of muscle and how much shoulder is going into it behind the organisation, apparently not a lot. But as you say, so there's five plus this sort of the sixth default. And then in terms of how this is structured internally, one of the things that I've seen is a spectrum of centrally organised versus local. You know, do banks have one central sort of fintech czar, as this sort of awful advert I saw for a large bank shall remain nameless a year ago, or are people just told to innovate and they do it locally? So how do you see this sort of central versus local spectrum? Because obviously there's reasons to centralise and coordinate, but there's also reasons for localism, because in large organisations, there ain't one generic thing that fits the sort of 4,052 business lines.
Look, I can share a bit from my perspective, from what I understand, from what I know, having lived that. For us, the fintech team as part of ING is very much there as a facilitator. We are there to enable the business, to help them. And, you know, we can do that in a few ways. We have sort of streamlined processes that they can use. We have a central database where we any interaction that we've had with a fintech that we record. And we have certain principles on the way that we operate. But this is really like a toolkit. And we can share that toolkit with some of the local countries, with some of the local staff that we've got there on the ground. So they can use this model in the same way, which again enables them to be able to work with fintechs. They can learn from other countries. They can learn from what we've experienced so that they can go faster, they can adapt better. But also as well, it's that, I suppose, trying to maintain a narrative. How do you want to be perceived in the world? Try and keep that common. So that's having a sort of central overview is really helpful. But as well, we're a small team, 6 people in the team, sort of half on the sort of scouting and analysis side of things, so really on the origination side, and then really conducting experiments, proof of concepts. And then we have the other half of the team, which is really the ventures part, which is about the investments, execution of the deals.
In a sense, the model you're talking about combines centralism and localism. It combines centralism in that there are these people who are experts in, shall we say, dating and mating.
Sure.
But at the same time, you're not there to tell me, a line manager, for example, what I ought to be doing and who I ought to acquire or who I ought to sort of date and mate with, but you're there to help me. So presumably in one or two ways, either you pop along and you see me one Monday morning and say, good morning, Mr. Ballyman, we're here to help. And I say, oh yes, how can you help me then? Or vice versa, that I've sort of seen a fintech and I think, God, they're really hot. I'll have them kind of thing, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, and this is it, right? Because we operate really in sort of two modes, which is really proactive, we call it, which is engagement, going into the business, speaking to the senior leaders, talking about this is what we've observed externally, this is disruption that's happening, or these are potential players that you could work with. Also showing some use cases of how we've worked with other parts of the organisation as well. And then explaining some of the processes that we've got in place that can help them to facilitate. Now, the other way, the other approach is, as you described, is more of a reactive, which is, yes, they've spotted this fintech, they've fallen in love with this thing, it's the best thing since sliced bread, and they just know they want to do something together. But then really, this is where we can help out, because have we already dated them in another country? Have we already had an experience which we can share? Are there any other candidates out there which, you know, could potentially fit that business need? And so we'll help out with the sort of landscaping, the analysis, and really sort of going from this is what we observe, but these are some recommendations on how to approach this.
And I was mentioning before, and I know you guys have been doing some work with Illuminate Financial, Mark's model of innovate, validate, adopt. So, for example, if I'm a line manager, I'm unlikely to have had much experience of innovation, validation and adoption, but you guys will have had quite a lot. So you can come along and tell me, well, actually, of these, we've done over 100 partnerships, Mike, so far, and actually 42 we did this way, 37 we did that way and that way. And we found that in general, it's much better to approach it this way, have a small pilot, have a big pilot, have a paid-for pilot, have a not-paid-for pilot, and, you know, just basically share your kind of Kama Sutra of how to mate successfully.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, for us, we've got a bit of a track record now. We've currently have about 115 active partnerships in place today. It would have been 140, but 25 of those we've stopped. We've killed them off for whatever reasons. It didn't work out. But then not everything is going to be successful. This is innovation after all. If you go to the Illuminate Financial model, I think what those guys are doing is great. What they're doing really echoes what we're doing as a team in the fintech team. But there's always that link of being in the business. For us, we have one foot firmly outside, looking what's going on, new trends, the technologies that are emerging, what are these new business models. But also we have one foot firmly embedded inside the organisation to find those business units with challenges, with problems, and to connect them up, really. Yeah. So it's having that the vantage point of each angle.
Well, that's very interesting. I must say, that's a sort of just an accurate remark, that it seems remarkably professional, actually, which may sound rather rude, but of course, I have heard of other banks other than ING, and some banks anyway, certainly a little time ago, I think most of them are getting better at it. A number of them indulge in what I call initiative-itis. So in the big picture of things, banks spent a lot of time recovering from 2008 and lots of stuff to sort out very literally in many cases, and there's this sort of fintech stuff happening in the side, And it really was a sideline, it really was a distraction. But then what happened is that the big consultancy spent a few years going along to see the main boards time and time again and getting more and more hysterical, and you know, the likes of McKinsey saying, oh, banks are going to lose 60% of your profits, which sounds complete crap to me.
We've used that slide.
Exactly. All of them have to get something happening. But anyway, so the tone got more and more shrill. Some fintechs did carry on getting slightly bigger, although I don't think any of them are scaring any of the big banks whatsoever yet, in terms of what I've seen. And in some organisations, not ING, but in some organisations, this initiativitis, as I call it, which is that eventually the chairman or the chief executive at a board meeting looks around and thumps the table and says, something must be done. He looks around and points his finger at all the business heads and goes, do something. And then they go away and do something. And, you know, randomly you get a whole bunch of stuff in a pretty uncoordinated fashion across the organisation. And clearly that's not the most effective. So I just wanted to put that out there because there is a spectrum between what you're doing. And I like the way that you combine the centralism and localism at the same time. And, you know, the selfie point aside was you wouldn't have been on the show just because of the selfie. So people stopped mugging me in the streets for selfies because you weren't going to show that. But actually, I was about to say it turned out by chance. But of course, it's not chance because all of the listeners to the London FinTech Podcast are wise, professional individuals that actually you guys have got a good approach to this. So moving on to the dating part of it, as it were. You say you've got one foot outside the organisation and one foot in. You've got a circle on one side, you've got a square on the other. How does one approach connecting a sort of circle and the squares? Because I say they're very different things.
Yeah, very concretely, I mean, for us, it's really having guiding principles, which is that we need to identify, you know, a real business problem, a real challenge that needs to be solved. We need that buy-in, yeah, from the organisation. So, because we've done it before in the past. Yes, it might sound very professional and mature today, but I've had the war scars from trying to push stuff through the organisation.
Just on that one, because I don't think there's a contradiction. I mean, you mentioned before that you've let whatever it was 25 go, or you've pruned 25 off the tree that you're growing. And I always had this cultural problem when I was running risk at Climate, especially with corporate finance, for some reason. Traders try and learn from their trading. You know, in trading, you can be the brilliant trader if you're right 51% of the time. So actually, as a trader, it's almost less interesting to look at the 51% where you're right, and it's very important to learn from the 49% where you got it wrong. Corporate finance had this terrible problem. Their culture was much more to cover up any failure, sweep it under the carpet, etc., etc. But I don't believe the word failure as such. Everything we do in life is an experiment, and it's really important to learn from the experiments that don't work out.
Yeah,
they teach you more than the ones that do, in a sense.
I think Anthony Robbins has a great quote, which is, when we succeed, we party, but when we fail, we ponder. Yes. But yeah, I mean, there's more to be learnt from our failures, because again, to that quote, that's really when we dive in and we retrospectively analyse and think, okay, if we could do this again, how would we improve it? If we succeed, we don't look at it.
Yeah, it's continuous upgrade. It's like you learn a bit about walking by walking, but you learn more by falling over and working out why you fell over and why you tripped over. You know, your internal modus operandi, your understanding of the world, goes from V1.1 to V1.2 to V1.3. And if you're getting anywhere, then in a year's time and 2 years' time and 3 years' time, you're far better at doing what you do then than you are now. So what kind of lessons have been learned along the way so far?
One of the things that we've learned is really getting that seniority buy-in. Yeah, and that's almost management board level minus one, minus two, because you need that. It's not just about money to invest or to do a proof of concept, to, you know, settle the commercial agreement, but it's about also freeing up resources inside the organisation. Who are the topic experts that are going to be able to validate that these business models are actually something of value to our customers, that actually they can deliver on their promises? So, you know, we have to have that seniority buy-in to really give us the resources which can help, yeah, which is massively important. And the other thing that we've also learned, which we've changed, we adapted, and we've had this in place for a couple of years, which was really the traditional procurement process, let's say, doesn't work for startups, for fintechs. They can't work to these sort of 6, 12, 18-month lead times. It just doesn't work for them. So we recognised that a couple of years ago, and so we have a very, we call it a fast-track process, something that's in place now, so that we can do a proof of concept with a fintech, and we aim to do that within 4 weeks' time. That is something very useful to the business. They see it that we can go very fast. But it's also really useful to the fintechs as well, because they're just not stuck in these long lead times, which can kill them off potentially. So it's having these tools at our disposal as well, which really enables us to go fast.
So I was about to say it's like you're bilingual, but actually it's much more like you're bicultural. And you understand, for the sake of argument, what it feels like to be French and what it feels like to be German. And therefore you can see it from both the perspectives, and you can see where... talk about it as a marriage, you can see where you've got a French person marrying a German person, where one side needs to adapt and the other side needs to adapt. So there's some sort of modus vivendi, some way of living together and thriving together.
Yeah, and it is. I suppose it's just having that empathy to be able to see from both sides of the fence and to really bring those together. But again, it's that educating the internal teams, not just the business units, but the people that we have to work with in procurement, in risk, in compliance, in IT, so that they are also understanding, okay, we can't apply the same frameworks that we do for tier one organisations. We need to streamline these processes on how we look at some of the smaller players.
Excellent. And so, coming on to the Kama Sutra of meeting banks with fintechs, how do you do it? Going back to these partnerships, there's over 100. Have you done it 100 different ways, or are there basically two or three different ways?
To be honest, it really depends. It's definitely not the same. You know, I can hand on heart say that not one of those has been set up in exactly the same way. What we do is that we learn from each partnership that we've done so that we can improve the process and we can get better at it. But again, try not to duplicate what I was saying before, but you know, some of those partnerships have come from opportunities that we've spotted and we've gone to the business and educated them and got them involved. But the other way is very much from the business of seeing the opportunities. But then we've worked on mapping out the landscaping and then going from, well, this is a long list, to crafting a shorter list, doing workshops, doing demos, really getting to get under the skin of some of these guys. But then I suppose the gem in the crown is really being able to do these proof of concepts, to be able to run these experiments, because you only really get to know or get into bed with some of these players, you know, when you actually do something together, yeah, when you actually kick the tires to see whether the technology works, whether the team is right, whether the relationship is right. Some of these startups might not like to work with us. They might not get a good feeling about that. They might not get the response time in 4 weeks' time, and this is not congruent to their way of working. So that sort of proof of concept is really, I suppose, that's the first date. Yeah, when we get to really see whether we actually do like each other, whether our customers like you, whether the technology works, or whether the business unit works, but flipping it over, whether the fintech or the startup actually likes working with us as well.
Yes, and I think that's obviously the key, which is to try doing something together. And I worked this out from first principles myself when I set up my own fintech in 1998. And the way I ended up sort of summarising it, which is that, look, I can come in here today, I can do a marketing presentation to you, I can take you through a little PowerPoint. All you will ever get out of this, no matter how many times you get me to come back and answer more and more questions, will be, in principle, this is of interest to us. Yeah?
Yes.
I hear what you say, Mike. In principle, that's of interest. We don't actually know in practice. Yeah. Well, what matters is actually just to find out in practice. Yeah. So I always used to say, well, look, give me some of your data. I shall go away and I shall come back with your data and show you what it looks like from this.
Yeah.
And then you'll have a feel that, ah, in practice, this is really interesting. Right, now let's get serious. So, you know, how much is it going to cost? How long does it take? And da-di-da-di-da-di. So I think that you bridge very well the needs of the two organisations, because, not mixing my metaphors, or only mixing them slightly, you have to lick it to taste it, really. And of course, I'm talking about ice creams here. You know,
sure.
I've got a new type of ice cream you've never tasted before. I can spend ages explaining this ice cream to you. Or we can, oh, have a lick. Yeah, have one of ice creams. Yeah, we'll make you one. Here we go. What do you think? Oh, that's quite nice, actually. You know, I never knew that sort of, you know, guava and pepper would be such a nice flavour of ice cream, but actually it is, and da-di-da-di-da-di. And I think there are plenty of organisations that are perhaps a bit too cautious or a bit too uncoordinated, or the more bureaucratic-y organisations that do get stuck in the analysis paralysis, Well, let's think about this. Let's analyse guava and pepper. How likely is guava and pepper ice cream to be nice, and how likely isn't it? And let's consult with other people and let's think about it a bit more. You're much just better just giving it a go. Oh, that didn't work out. Didn't like that. Okay, next.
On that very point is, and sort of looping it back to what we were talking about failure earlier on as well, not a lot of people want to fail. Yeah, they get uncomfortable. Certainly within the financial area, we are sort of drummed into failure is not an option. So actually making a decision which can potentially not work, can potentially lose a little bit of money, yeah, like a little bit of time, a little bit of effort, but that in itself can be perceived as an area where not everybody wants to go. So it's really, you know, trying to change that culture, trying to change the outlook, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And it is definitely reframing failure. There was somebody that I worked with once back in the day whose proud boast was, he'd been in the banking division, and he'd never lent money and lost money on the loan, to which when he was out the room, other people would say, yeah, but he never lent money. As all bankers know, throughout entire history, all your loans ain't going to work out. Say, all traders really know that. All investment managers know that. For me, the best metaphor is simply how a toddler learns to walk. If that toddler ain't prepared to fall over, that toddler's going to be crawling all of its life. And there's no such thing as failure. As long as you live to tell the tale, as long as you don't break every bone in your body. And the secret to that is clearly setting success criteria up front and limiting the downside. You know, if somebody comes to you with a new sort of algorithm for assessing credit risk and you think it's really exciting, you don't use it across your entire loan book across the world.
No.
you might start in a smaller experiment fashion, as you say, with a sort of pilot and work on it from then. But I think that kind of stuff is relatively obvious. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there, and I'd like to thank Alex, the listener in here. And I'd like to thank my brand partners for the podcast. Blue Motor Finance combine extensive experience with a fresh and innovative approach. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over £500 million of lending to over 50,000 customers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So, Alex, in passing, you've told us quite a little bit about what you're doing and all that kind of stuff at ING, as well as situating it in the broader context of banks. And basically what we've said about banks pretty much applies to all incumbents in FS. So in terms of scattering some bread upon the water for the thousands of fishes out there, some of whom might like to nibble your bread, what kind of things are you looking for? If I had a magic wand and I could give you something for the next 12 months, what do you want more of in ING FinTech?
I love the magic wand question, yeah. But I mean, like, for me, I mean, like, if there's any semi-mature FinTechs or startups out there who are sort of Series A and beyond, they've raised a bit of money from friends and family and angel investors, you've got a proven business model, a product, something tangible in the market, and are looking for a strategic partner to scale in Europe, please get in touch. Secondly, I'd love to chat with the companies who are these conduits to these. I think Illuminate Financial, that was mentioned earlier, are a good example of this. They're really focused on a niche which can really help to shed the light for us on certain parts.
But there are many other niches, presumably, so you need more conduits to the other niches.
Yes, absolutely. And then finally, I'd say that we are launching FinTech Village, our accelerator in Belgium, that allows startups and scale-ups to work closely together with the bank. And we do that again via running proof of concepts. That program's just launched now, and we'll be closing on the 15th of December, 2017. So if anyone's in this area, please come and check us out.
So just on that, coming back to where we started, which is this motto of don't compete, is your Belgian accelerator competing or not competing?
For ING, it's the only one that we've got in Belgium.
For ING, so.
There are many accelerators running there. So.
In Belgium? Oh, right, OK. I must do something on Belgian accelerators one day when I run out of ideas. Good. OK, well, thank you for that, Alex. It's been very clear. And I think that the main feeling that I have as a takeaway, so we spoke about some of this more superficially, but speaking in it more detail, which is that ING is one bank. Actually, they were a client of mine for my fintech way back in the past when it was ING Bearings, David Robbins, the chief executive. So I knew them a little. I knew that they're like drinking milk in Holland, which makes them all very tall. But it was a conversation I was having last week, actually, with people that quite often people misunderstand the nature of incumbents. They can look sort of slow and leaden-footed and all that kind of stuff. But equally, when something sort of huge and slow and leaden-footed gets moving, it has a hell of a lot of momentum. And in all organisations, there are some bright people who learn from their mistakes and get more professional over time. And once the incumbents start learning the lessons, then I think actually you're going to be reading more media articles in the next 1, 2, 3 years about the fintechs having to worry about the incumbents, not vice versa. Sure. I mentioned app banking and all that kind of stuff, and people have heard on the show many times that I quite like the fact that Monzo gives you geolocated expenses. Well, big, slow IT departments in big, slow banks, it may take them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, but they're all going to have it at some point in the future, at which point, in a world of information, in a data world, in an ideas world, all of that kind of stuff can be copied. So I think this is really, in a sense, an opportunity for some fintechs to contact, as you say, and interact with a very successful organisation. But also, I think, coming back to the point about competition and podcasts, I think one of the most important things we've glossed over is it's important not to be complacent. It's quite good to have some competition, even if it's not a Chinese restaurant, even if it's an Albanian restaurant next door, because the competition is what keeps us on our toes. And certainly in fintech is going to have competition not just from other fintechs, but it's going to have increasing amount of competition from the incumbents as they sort of wake from their slumber and they start moving, now that we're pretty much post 2008, and they can devote more resources to it and put the smart people on the case. So I wish you every success in the future, Alex.
Thanks, Mike. I couldn't agree more.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.